Money Men is the stranger than fiction story of Wirecard, once a $30 billion tech darling and now a smouldering wreck by the journalist who brought it crashing down. That journalist is Dan McCrum. To tell us more about this fascinating tale is Dan himself. Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure is all mine. It was the time of tech darlings, wasn't it? Everybody seemed to have a dot-com. Every single celebrity had the next big thing. Wirecard, with $30 billion, crashed and burned. Give me a little background to what exactly Wirecard was.
Oh, well, it's the spirit of the age, isn't it? The, you know, tech companies are the next big thing. And this one was just really a European PayPal. It was one of Europe's biggest financial tech companies. But what I discovered as I started to look into it was rotten to its core. It was, as you said, this 30 billion euro fraud. And the wild thing about it is, you know, this book is the story of the investigation. And it, you know, it sort of reads like a thriller with all these bizarre characters on the inside and these things you just wouldn't expect to happen in real life. So I sort of start looking at it, and it's like going down the rabbit hole. You know, I've got sort of two children, and I'm trying to build a house while all of this is going on. And I start to realize I'm facing all of these black ops, you know, sort of hackers, surveillance, dirty tricks. You know, this company cooks up this sort of effort to frame me for insider trading. And so suddenly I find out that, you know, I start writing stories about the company saying, hey, there's a big fraud going on here. But the authorities start investigating me instead. Mm. So on that side of it, it really shows the pressure journalists are under when you're trying to bring these big stories to life. And then on the inside, you have all of these crazy characters, like the main bad guy has these harebrained schemes. You know, they almost destroy the company time and again. And he's got a bit of a James Bond fixation, and he's trying to hang out with Libyan militias. So, I don't know, does that give you a little flavor of the madness?
Yeah, exactly. But, it seems to be, as always with these situations, we see it that, you know, as we said, it's the tech darlings. It's everybody, all the big financial institutions are frightened of missing the next big thing. So they go headlong into backing or getting involved with these companies without sort of asking questions. And they sort of leave their brains on the front desk.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the biggest tech companies in Europe, and it just shows you how some of these companies are beyond oversight. The regulators weren't paying any attention. And the chief executive, he was this strange character, Marcus Brown. And he sort of tried to dress himself up, literally like Steve Jobs, you know, the famous Apple founder, wearing a black turtleneck. And he would talk with, you know, that sort of technology gobbledygook. He was a former management consultant, and, you know, it was all very blue sky. He would talk about they were going to bring in the cashless society. And you keep having these investors and bankers and regulators going to meet him and just being completely wowed, as if it really is the next big thing.
So what was the modus operandi? What was Wirecard being then? Was it a European sort of version of PayPal? And why did you start looking into, you know, the strangeness behind it?
Yeah, so it was this European PayPal. It basically, if you had an online business, it would help you take credit and debit card payments from your customers. And I started looking at it 8 years ago because, in part, the numbers were a little bit too good to be true. It was growing so quickly, it was making so much money, you kind of scratched your head and said, hang on, how is it doing something which everybody else can't? But also I got these great tips from these hedge fund managers. There was this Australian guy who, I'm just chatting to him, and he says to me, Dan, would you be interested in some German gangsters? And so I started to dig into it. And the more I looked, the more none of it made sense. And one of the amazing things about finally being able to tell all the story is I can sort of talk about all the strange things which happened behind the scenes, which we couldn't put in print at the time. So we start writing about it. And normally big companies have PR firms who get in touch and, you know, tell you why the company is brilliant and all those sorts of things. But then suddenly we're writing about it, and the owner of a large London nightclub called Fabric, who's one of my colleague's secret sources, starts calling up and saying, yeah, I've got a senior executive at this German financial institution who wants to talk to you. And when that sort of strange stuff starts happening, you're like, okay, there's something very strange going on here.
You mentioned that the sort of the Bond fixation and wanting to hang out with Libyan warlords. Now, you know, this is and Marcus Brown is from Austria, and then they're not known for sort of wanting to hang out with Libyan warlords. So, you know, shouldn't that have rang some very loud Teutonic alarm bells?
You would have thought so, but it was this sort of double life. So Marcus Brown was the guy in charge. And then the real enigma at the heart of this is his second in command, Jan Marsalek, who is still missing, by the way. When Wirecard collapsed, he got on a plane to Belarus and is now thought to be in Moscow.
Right.
And it turns out it wasn't just Libyan militias he was friends with. He also had Russian mercenaries who were hanging out with him. And he seemed to accumulate all these spies as friends, but it's not clear. Was he actually a spy himself, or was he just this chancer who had a bit of a James Bond wannabe complex? So there's this moment where he's hanging out with his friends, including one of these Russian mercenaries, and he's complaining that he can never go on holiday because he's such a workaholic. And the Russian says to him, hey, well, what is it you want to do? He says, I want to do something no one else in the world can. So he says, all right then, I'll take you to Syria. And he goes and has a stroll around Palmyra, which has just been retaken from ISIS, with the Russian army.
Right.
So you have all of this sort of, and yeah, you kind of step back and say, why was no one important in Europe really paying attention to what was happening here and this guy?
And presumably, you know, if you're running the European version of PayPal with cash flying left, right and centre electronically, if my business is slightly less than legal and doesn't exactly have the cleanest of balance sheets, surely, you know, making friends with the chief executive of the European version of PayPal is going to be a very handy thing for me to wash, launder, send money to, shall we say, some interesting companies, some interesting groups?
You've hit the nail on the head there. Wirecard would have been very useful to some of these intelligence organizations. And they kind of boasted about it a little bit, although they would say they were helping out German intelligence, you know, to their friends, just quietly, oh, yes, we're very well connected. And so, yeah, the fact that he's disappeared and he's still on the run does make you think, maybe there's some more to this to still come out.
When did you realize that you were digging? And these are some pretty unsavory individuals. I mean, you can look at Marcus Brown as a classic case of geeks gone wrong or trying to sort of live out their fantasies in real life, because we see this with them quite a lot, you know, with the internet billionaires, you know, who've never met a real woman in their life, et cetera, and have never been the tough guy at school, so want to start hanging out and living the gangster lifestyle. But it started to interrupt on your lifestyle, because if you are, you know, as the saying goes, you know, do not meddle with the affairs of dragons because you are crispy and you taste good with tomato ketchup. But you must have thought, hang on a second, I'm dealing with militias. I'm dealing with people who pop over to Syria for holidays and hang out with, as I said before, with Libyan warlords. They're not going to go, oh, he's just a journalist sniffing around. And there's nothing like, you know, a gangster likes better than to rough up a journalist.
I mean, there were moments which were genuinely terrifying. And there's one which always sticks in my mind. And so my wife, Charlotte, who I talk about her in the book, and I always had her support, and she was incredible. And there's this moment where we get told that one of the plans which the private detectives has considered, but at that point decided not to put into action, is the old gangland trick, where they're going to plant drugs in my car and then call the police. And we're sort of, initially we're like laughing about this because it's like, well, that would be crazy. But then, you know, the reality hits home and she's sort of like, this could completely blow up our lives. you know, imagine if the police start knocking on our doors. And she said something to me that I think really sums up how it felt at times, where she was like, these guys have all the money, so they're going to win. They always do. And that was a moment. It really felt like just the mismatch in resources and, you know, the things at their disposal, which they could do to try and stop us, you know, almost felt insurmountable.
What was, I mean, Brown was eventually brought down, but he brought in cash to fake, was it feigned income? He was inflating his assets and the volume of sales, because he was basically, was it making ghost transactions to make it look more attractive to these banks who were going to back him?
Yeah, it's incredible how when these frauds come down to it, they're really very simple at the heart. It's this clever little fraud where Wirecard said, well, our business is processing credit card payments, but we don't do all of it ourselves. We have three friends who help us, and they're based in different parts of the world, and we send them a load of business, and then they send us big commissions back, and it's really profitable. And it turned out that was more than half their business. And it was a bit like saying, oh, yeah, my friend across the road, he's the one who's got all the money. Don't worry, he's looking after it. And then it turned out, of course, that these friends weren't real and there was no money at all.
But at that time, they'd overtaken, you know, places like respected German financial institutions, Commerzbank, Deutsche Bank. I mean, these are the big hitters. Weren't they claiming that they were sending these funds via two clearing banks in the Philippines, which, with the greatest respect to the Philippines, isn't exactly a major financial world trading hub?
One of the so strange things that I try to bring out is, the people who are encountering Wirecard and, you know, also traveling down the rabbit hole, but they were the ones, you know, the auditors and the accountants who were supposed to go, yes, everything is okay. And you have these moments where they go to the Philippines and they say, okay, yes, all of your money is in these two banks. It's a little bit odd, but okay, let's go with it. And they show up at the office of the person who's in charge of these accounts for Wirecard, a very large European financial institution. And it's a Manila divorce lawyer who also has a bit of a YouTube following. You know, he has one of those plaques on his wall saying he's got 100,000 subscribers. And there's this bizarre moment where they all go in and he sort of talks about how influential and important he is. And then he takes them off to the tiny branches where they get handed, where they get handed envelopes with, you know, little bits of paper which say, yes, everything is fine. There is €1 billion in this bank and there's €1 billion in that bank. And when you step back and sort of look at it now, it all, like, you just can't believe that these guys thought it was real. And that's one of the, you know, the puzzles at the heart of it. How do these people get taken in by everything that was so strange?
What about other employees? We talked about the number two who got on a plane and was never seen again. But were there rank and file? Were there people who actually believed that they were working for a proper company? And if so, what was their reaction when it all came crashing down?
So after Wirecard collapsed, I was lucky enough to go to Munich and get a tour of their offices. And I met a lot of the former employees. And most of them were very shell-shocked because they thought they had been working inside this big successful company. And what you discover are the stories which people tell themselves. So I was looking for fraud. And every time I found something that looked off, I would go, aha, this points to them being bad guys. But when you're on the inside, you're doing the reverse thing, aren't you? You're looking for reasons to explain things which don't fit. So they would tell themselves, okay, we're just a fast-growing startup. You know, they were living by, like, the Facebook mantra, move fast and break things. And so they kind of just convinced themselves that the strange things they saw, the fact that, you know, the technology they had to deal with on a day-to-day basis was terrible and hardly worked, while the company's presenting itself to the outside world as this incredible tech visionary innovator. And yet, one of the amazing things, our ability to deceive ourselves when it's in our own interest, because they're all getting paid very well, of course.
Mm. Yeah, it's a sort of group psychosis. When it did come crashing down, I mean, it came crashing down very, very quickly indeed. And the German authorities said there was just the small matter of a financial black hole that was 1.9 billion euros.
So the final day when it came crashing down was this moment where suddenly they have to announce, yes, we can't find the cash. And to begin with, they claim it's missing. And the chief executive, Marcus Braun, he stands up and he says, I'm the victim. This is my fortune. He was the biggest investor in the company himself. And he's about to go on trial in the autumn. And he still claims that he's completely innocent and that he was duped as well. And his deputy, the guy who's disappeared to Moscow, is the one who fooled even him. But there's this strange aspect as well, which is the company announces all the money's missing and it completely collapses. But the German authorities are in no rush to arrest anyone. They take 3 or 4 days to issue arrest warrants, by which time, you know, the master criminal has got on this plane and left the country. And so you're left with that nagging question of, well, it was very convenient for everybody that the guy who really knows what happened has been allowed to disappear.
Is it because, do you think, Dan, that obviously if the great, you know, we hold, or we were supposed to hold these financial institutions in and our financial regulators in with some sort of respect, that they know what they're doing. But this was clearly a case where they had been hoodwinked, they'd been, you know, bedazzled by the European version of a Steve Jobs. Also, they wanted to believe so badly that this was, you know, a case of financial brilliance they were getting involved in, that they couldn't accept the glaring errors, the glaring sort of missteps that were happening with hindsight, they were so obvious.
It's a failure of imagination, isn't it? The regulators, the police, they all looked at this company. You know, the guys were wearing suits and ties. They were charming. They were smartly dressed. They were doing all the things that make you go, they don't look like criminals. They don't sound like criminals. And so I think they found it very hard to even imagine that they could be criminals. And this is why frauds like Wirecard are so insidious. Because what they do is they sort of abuse that trust in society. You know, they can exist because we all generally trust each other and assume, you know, business people, big companies aren't criminal organizations which are trying to rip us off. And so when they do get exposed, and it turns out nothing happened, and, you know, you saw this with the financial crisis, you've seen this with a bunch of scandals, that sort of erodes the trust that we have in these institutions, and, you know, the trust in society, which is so valuable to, you know, to the way we live our lives and do business.
So where are we now? What is Marcus Braun? You said that obviously he, you know, it came down crashing in a matter of weeks. Facing trial, what's the outcome? What are we expecting? And also, what do you hope that people are going to take from this really rip-roaring sort of financial crime story?
So Marcus Braun and a couple of his accomplices are going on trial in the autumn. And I very much hope that they get found guilty. But what I want people to take away from the story, in part, is to sort of show the pressure that journalists are under when they're trying to expose these sorts of criminals. Because it's become routine, really, you know, that we have to be aware of hacking, data security, dirty tricks, and in particular, you know, the use of lawyers to try and squash stories. I mean, this is a very topical issue in the UK at the moment, where we've had Russian oligarchs for years using the courts to basically stop stories getting written. And Wirecard tried the same thing against us. So, you know, if one thing comes from it, I would just hope it adds to that momentum to sort of support journalists when they're doing these sorts of difficult, hard and, you know, somewhat astounding stories.
But the thing, here's the thing, Dan, here's the thing. You see, the problem is that, and we're talking about 21st century, you know, Wirecard, cashless payment, you know, in, you said, you know, the guy in the Philippines had a YouTube following, etc. And the way that people digest and want their news now is basically in under 250 words. So you have to wonder, you know, the odds are stacked against you if you try and do an in-depth report investigation of this type, because people will try and crush it. People will try and say, oh, if it's bigger than a tweet, I don't want to read it. So, you know, hats off to you to actually, you know, having the chutzpah to go off and do this.
Well, thank you, Charles. And I would say I've got more faith in people than that. I think when organizations like the Financial Times produce great journalism, there is an audience for it and a market for it. And people do care about these sorts of stories, even if, you know, there is the distraction of social media and short bursts and everything else. So, you know, I've still got faith that journalism can bring things to light. And, you know, there are these amazing stories out there to tell, you know, which is why I put them all into the book. And, you know, I really hope that people respond to that.
The book is called Money Men, A Hot Startup, A $1 billion Fraud and A Fight for Truth. It's by Dan McCrum, who we've been speaking to today. Dan, if people want to find you in a nice kind of way on the internet, where can they get hold of you? Where can they find what you're up to?
I'm on Twitter at FD is probably the easiest way to find me.
FD was that?
Yes, FD. I was on Twitter, you know, embarrassingly early.
Right, fair enough. Well, it's good to get in early, as the saying goes. Like these companies try to do with what they thought Wirecard was going to be. The book is called Money Men, A Hot Startup, A $1 billion Fraud, A Fight for Truth. It's by Dan McCrum, who we've been speaking to today. Dan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. It's been great.